life, because it bears so many evils. Alexander succeeded in taking out of India, as his teacher, a true yogi. This man was Swami Sphenes, called Kalanos by the Greeks because the saint, a devotee of God in the form of Kali, greeted everyone by pronouncing her auspicious name. Kalanos accompanied Alexander to Persia. On a stated day, at Susa in Persia, Kalanos gave up his aged body by entering a funeral pyre in view of the whole Macedonian army. The historians record the astonishment of the soldiers who observed that the yogi had no fear of pain or death, and who never once moved from his position as he was consumed in the flames. Before leaving for his cremation, Kalanos had embraced all his close companions, but refrained from bidding farewell to Alexander, to whom the Hindu sage had merely remarked, "I shall see you shortly in Babylon." Alexander left Persia, and died a year later in Babylon. His Indian guru's words had been his way of saying he would be present with Alexander in life and death. The Greek historians have left us many vivid and inspiring pictures of Indian society. Hindu law, Aryan tells us, protects the people and ordains that no one among them shall, under any circumstances, be a slave but that, enjoying freedom themselves, they shall respect the equal right to it which all possess. For those, they thought, who have learned neither to domineer over nor cringe to others will attain the life best adapted for all vicissitudes of lot. The Indians, runs another text, neither put out money at usury, nor know how to borrow. It is contrary to established usage for an Indian either to do or suffer a wrong, and therefore they neither make contracts nor require securities. Healing, we are told, was by simple and natural means. Cures are effected rather by regulating diet than by the use of medicines. The remedies most esteemed are ointments and plasters. All others are considered to be in great measure pernicious. Engagement in war was restricted to the Kshatriyas or warrior caste. Nor would an enemy coming upon a husbandman and his work on his land do him any harm, for men of this class, being regarded as public benefactors, are protected from all injury. The land thus remaining unravaged and producing heavy crops, supplies the inhabitants with the requisites to make life enjoyable. The Emperor Chandragupta, who in 305 BC had defeated Alexander's general, Seleucus, decided 7 years later to hand over the reins of India's government to his son. Traveling to South India, Chandragupta spent the last 12 years of his life as a penniless ascetic, seeking self-realization in a rocky cave at Sravanabhlagola, now honored as a Mysore shrine. Nearby stands the world's largest statue, carved out of an immense boulder by the Jains in AD 983 to honor the saint Kameswara. The ubiquitous religious shrines of Mysore are a constant reminder of the many great saints of South India. One of these masters, Thumanava, has left us the following challenging poem. You can control a mad elephant, you can shut the mouth of the bear and the tiger, you can ride a lion, you can play with the cobra, by alchemy you can eke out your livelihood, you can wander through the universe incognito, in the beautiful and fertile state of Travancore in the extreme south of India, where traffic is conveyed over rivers and canals. The Maharaja assumes every year a hereditary obligation to expiate the sin incurred by wars and the annexation in the distant past of several petty states to Travancore. For 56 days annually the Maharaja visits the temple thrice daily to hear Vedic hymns and recitations. The expiation ceremony ends with the Lakshadipamur illumination of the temple by 100,000 lights. The great Hindu lawgiver Manu has outlined the duties of a king. He should shower amenities like Indra, lord of the gods, collect taxes gently and imperceptibly as the sun obtains vapor from water, enter into the life of his subjects as the wind goes everywhere, mete out even justice to all like Yama, god of death, bind transgressors in a noose like Varuna, Vedic deity of sky and wind, please all like the moon, burn up vicious enemies like the god of fire, and support all like the earth goddess. In war a king should not fight with poisonous or fiery weapons nor kill weak or unready or weaponless foes or men who are in fear or who pray for protection or who run away. War should be resorted to only as a last resort. Results are always doubtful in war. Madras Presidency on the southeast coast of India contains the flat, spacious, sea-girt city of Madras, and Conjeeveram, the Golden City, capital site of the Pallava dynasty whose kings ruled during the early centuries of the Christian era. In modern Madras Presidency, the non-violent ideals of Mahatma Gandhi have made great headway. The white distinguishing Gandhi caps are seen everywhere. In the south generally, the Mahatma has effected many important temple reforms for untouchables as well as caste system reforms. The origin of the caste system, formulated by the great legislator Manu, was admirable. He saw clearly that men are distinguished by natural evolution into four great classes: those capable of offering service to society through their bodily labor, sudras; those who serve through mentality, skill, agriculture, trade, commerce, business life in general; vaisyas, those whose talents are administrative, executive, and protective; rulers and warriors, kshatriyas, those of contemplative nature, spiritually inspired and inspiring Brahmins. Neither birth nor sacraments nor study nor ancestry can decide whether a person is twice born, that is, a Brahmin. The Mahabharata declares, character and conduct only can decide. Manu instructed society to show respect to its members insofar as they possessed wisdom, virtue, age, kinship or, lastly, wealth. Riches in Vedic India were always despised if they were hoarded or unavailable for charitable purposes. Ungenerous men of great wealth were assigned a low rank in society. Serious evils arose when the caste system became hardened through the centuries into a hereditary halter. Social reformers like Gandhi and the members of very numerous societies in India today are making slow but sure progress in restoring the ancient values of caste, based solely on natural qualification and not on birth. Every nation on earth has its own distinctive misery-producing karma to deal with and remove. India, too, with her versatile and invulnerable spirit, shall prove herself equal to the task of caste reformation. So entrancing is southern India that Mr. Wright and I yearned to prolong our riddle. But time, in its immemorial rudeness, dealt us no courteous extensions. I was scheduled soon to address the concluding session of the Indian Philosophical Congress at Calcutta University. At the end of the visit to Mysore, I enjoyed a talk with Sir C. V. Raman, President of the Indian Academy of Sciences. This brilliant Hindu physicist was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1930 for his important discovery in the diffusion of light, the Riemann effect, now known to every schoolboy. Waving a reluctant farewell to a crowd of Madras students and friends, Mr. Wright and I set out for the north. On the way we stopped before a little shrine sacred to the memory of Sadasaiva Brahman, in whose 18th century life story miracles cluster thickly. A larger Sadasaiva shrine at Nura, erected by the Raja of Pudukkottai, is a pilgrimage spot which has witnessed numerous divine healings. Many quaint stories of Sadasaiva, a lovable and fully illumined master, are still current among the South Indian villagers. Immersed one day in Samadhi on the bank of the Kaveri River, Sadasaiva was seen to be carried away by a sudden flood. Weeks later he was found buried deep beneath a mound of earth. As the villagers' shovel struck his body, the saint rose and walked briskly away. Sadasaiva never spoke a word or wore a cloth. One morning the nude yogi unceremoniously entered the tent of a Mohammedan chieftain. His ladies screamed in alarm, their warrior dealt a savage sword thrust at Sadasaiva, whose arm was severed. The master departed unconcernedly. Overcome by remorse, the Mohammedan picked up the arm from the floor and followed Sadasaiva. The yogi quietly inserted his arm into the bleeding stump. When the warrior humbly asked for some spiritual instruction, Sadasaiva wrote with his finger on the sands, "Do not do what you want, and then you may do what you like." The Mohammedan was uplifted to an exalted state of mind, and understood the saint's paradoxical advice to be a guide to soul freedom through mastery of the ego. The village children once expressed a desire in Sadasaiva's presence to see the Madura religious festival, 150 miles away. The yogi indicated to the little ones that they should touch his body. Lo! Instantly the whole group was transported to Madhura. The children wandered happily among the thousands of pilgrims. In a few hours the yogi brought his small charges home by his simple mode of transportation. The astonished parents heard the vivid tales of the procession of images, and noted that several children were carrying bags of Madhura sweets. An incredulous youth derided the scent and the story. The following morning he approached Sadasiva. "Master," he said scornfully, "why don't you take me to the festival, even as you did yesterday for the other children?" Sadasiva complied. The boy immediately found himself among the distant city throng. But alas! Where was the saint when the youth wanted to leave? The weary boy reached his home by the ancient and prosaic method of foot locomotion. Chapter 42. Last Days with My Guru. "Uruji, I am glad to find you alone this morning. I had just arrived at the Serampore Hermitage, carrying a fragrant burden of fruit and roses." Sri Yukteswar glanced at me meekly. "What is your question?" Master looked about the room as though he were seeking escape. "Guruji, I came to you as a high school youth, now I am a grown man, even with a grey hair or two. Though you have showered me with silent affection from the first hour to this, do you realize that once only, on the day of meeting, have you ever said, 'I love you'?" I looked at him pleadingly. Master lowered his gaze. "Yogananda, must I bring out into the cold realms of speech the warm sentiments best guarded by the wordless heart? Guruji, I know you love me, but my mortal ears ache to hear you say so." "Be it as you wish. During my married life I often yearned for a son, to train in the yogic path. But when you came into my life, I was content. In you I have found my son." Two clear teardrops stood in Sri Yukteswar's eyes. "Yogananda, I love you always. Your answer is my passport to heaven." I felt a weight lift from my heart, dissolved forever at his words. Often had I wondered at his silence, realizing that he was unemotional and self-contained, yet sometimes I feared I had been unsuccessful in fully satisfying him. His was a strange nature, never utterly to be known, a nature deep and still, unfathomable to the outer world, whose values he had long transcended. A few days later, when I spoke before a huge audience at Albert Hall in Calcutta, Sri Yukteswar consented to sit beside me on the platform, with the Maharaja of Santosh and the Mayor of Calcutta. Though Master made no remark to me, I glanced at him from time to time during my address, and thought I detected a pleased twinkle in his eyes. Then came a talk before the alumni of Serampore College. As I gazed upon my old classmates, and as they gazed on their own mad monk, tears of joy showed unashamedly. My silver-tongued professor of philosophy, Dr. Goshal, came forward to greet me, all our past misunderstandings dissolved by the alchemist time. A winter solstice festival was celebrated at the end of December in the Serampore Hermitage. As always, Sri Yukteswar's disciples gathered from far and near. Devotional sankirtans, solos in the nectar-sweet voice of Christo Da, a feast served by young disciples, Master's profoundly moving discourse under the stars in the thronged courtyard of the ashram, memories. Joyous festivals of years long past. Tonight, however, there was to be a new feature. "Yogananda, please address the assemblage in English." Master's eyes were twinkling as he made this doubly unusual request. Was he thinking of the shipboard predicaments that had preceded my first lecture in English? I told the story to my audience of brother disciples, ending with a fervent tribute to our guru. His omnipresent guidance was with me not alone on the ocean steamer, I concluded, but daily throughout my 15 years in the vast and hospitable land of America. After the guests had departed, Sri Yukteswar called me to the same bedroom where once only, after a festival of my early years, I had been permitted to sleep on his wooden bed. Tonight my guru was sitting there quietly, a semicircle of disciples at his feet. He smiled as I quickly entered the room. "Yogananda, are you leaving now for Calcutta? Please return here tomorrow." I have certain things to tell you. The next afternoon, with a few simple words of blessing, Sri Yukteswar bestowed on me the further monastic title of Paramahansa. It now formally supersedes your former title of Swami, he said as I knelt before him. With a silent chuckle I thought of the struggle which my American students would undergo over the pronunciation of Paramahansaji. My task on earth is now finished, you must carry on. Master spoke quietly, his eyes calm and gentle. My heart was palpitating in fear. Please send someone to take charge of our ashram at Puri, Sri Yukteswar went on. I leave everything in your hands. You will be able to successfully sail the boat of your life and that of the organization to the divine shores. In tears, I was embracing his feet, he rose and blessed me endearingly. The following day I summoned from Ranchi a disciple, Swami Sabananda, and sent him to Puri to assume the hermitage duties. Later my guru discussed with me the legal details of settling his estate. He was anxious to prevent the possibility of litigation by relatives, after his death, for possession of his two hermitages and other properties, which he wished to be deeded over solely for charitable purposes. Arrangements were recently made for Master to visit Kidapur, I section, but he failed to go. Amulaya Babu, a brother disciple, made this remark to me one afternoon. I felt a cold wave of premonition. To my pressing inquiries, Sri Yukteswar only replied, I shall go to Kidapur no more. For a moment, Master trembled like a frightened child. Guruji, I entreated him with a sob, don't say that. Never utter those words to me. Sri Yukteswar's face relaxed in a peaceful smile. Though nearing his 81st birthday, he looked well and strong. Basking day by day in the sunshine of my guru's love, unspoken but keenly felt, I banished from my conscious mind the various hints he had given of his approaching passing. Sir, the Kumbh Mela is convening this month at Allahabad. I showed Master the Mela dates in a Bengali almanac. Do you really want to go? Not sensing Sri Yukteswar's reluctance to have me leave him, I went on, once you beheld the blessed sight of Babaji at an Allahabad Kumbh. Perhaps this time I shall be fortunate enough to see him. I do not think you will meet him there. My guru then fell into silence, not wishing to obstruct my plans. When I set out for Allahabad the following day with a small group, Master blessed me quietly in his usual manner. Apparently I was remaining oblivious to implications in Sri Yukteswar's attitude because the Lord wished to spare me the experience of being forced, helplessly, to witness my, the woman yogi, Shankari Mayaju, only living disciple of the great Trailanga Swami. The turbaned figure seated directly beside her is Swami Benoyananda, a director of Aranchai Yoga School for Boys in Bihar. The picture was taken at the Hardwar Kumbh Mela in 1938, the woman sent was then 112 years old. Guru's passing. It has always happened in my life that, at the death of those dearly beloved by me, God has compassionately arranged that I be distant from the scene. Our party reached the Kumbh Mela on January 23, 1936. The surging crowd of nearly 2 million persons was an impressive sight, even an overwhelming one. The peculiar genius of the Indian people is the reverence innate in even the lowliest peasant for the worth of the spirit, and for the monks and sadhus who have forsaken worldly ties to seek a diviner anchorage. Impostors and hypocrites there are indeed, but India respects all for the sake of the few who illumine the whole land with supernal blessings. Westerners who were viewing the vast spectacle had a unique opportunity to feel the pulse of the land, the spiritual ardor to which India owes her quenchless vitality before the blows of time. The first day was spent by our group in sheer staring. Here were countless bathers, dipping in the holy river for remission of sins. There we saw solemn rituals of worship, yonder were devotional offerings being strewn at the dusty feet of saints, a turn of our heads, and a line of elephants, caparisoned and horses and slow-paced Rajputana camels filed by, or a quaint religious parade of naked satyrs, waving scepters of gold and silver, or flags and streamers of silk and velvet. Anchorites wearing only loincloths sat quietly in little groups, their bodies besmeared with the ashes that protect them from the heat and cold. The spiritual eye was vividly represented on their foreheads by a single spot of sandalwood paste. Shaven-headed swamis appeared by the thousands, ochre-robed and carrying their bamboo staff and begging bowl. Their faces beamed with the renunciate's peace as they walked about or held philosophical discussions with disciples. Here and there under the trees, around huge piles of burning logs, were picturesque satyrs, with their hair braided and massed in coils on top of their heads. Some wore beards several feet in length, curled and tied in a knot. They meditated, quietly, or extended their hands in blessing to the passing throng beggars, maharajas on elephants, women in multicolored saris, their bangles and anklets tinkling, fake ears with thin arms held grotesquely aloft, brahmacaris carrying meditation elbow props, humble sages whose solemnity hidden in a bliss. High above the din we heard the ceaseless summons of the temple bells. On our second melody my companions and I entered various ashrams and temporary huts, offering pranams to saintly personages. We received the blessing of the leader of the Giri branch of the Swami Order, a thin, ascetical monk with eyes of smiling fire. Our next visit took us to a hermitage whose guru had observed for the past 9 years the vows of silence and a strict fruitarian diet. On the central dais in the ashram hall sat a blind sadhu, Pragla Chakzu, profoundly learned in the Shastras and highly revered by all sects. After I had given a brief discourse in Hindi on Vedanta, our group left the peaceful hermitage to greet a nearby Swami, Krishnananda, a handsome monk with rosy cheeks and impressive shoulders. Reclining near him was a tame lioness, succumbing to the monk's spiritual charm not, I am sure, to his powerful physique exclamation mark. The jungle animal refuses all meat in favor of rice and milk. The Swami has taught the tawny-haired beast to utter om in a deep, attractive growl, a cat devotee. Our next encounter, an interview with a learned young sadhu, is well described in Mr. Wright's sparkling travel diary. We rode in the ford across the very low Ganges on a creaking pontoon bridge, crawling snake-like through the crowds and over narrow, twisting lanes, passing the site on the river bank which Yoganandaji pointed out to me as the meeting place of Babaji and Sri Yatswarji. Alighting from the car a short time later, we walked some distance through the thickening smoke of the sadhus fires and over the slippery sands to reach a cluster of tiny, very modest mud and straw huts. We halted in front of one of these insignificant temporary dwellings, with a pygmy doorless entrance, the shelter of Karapatri, a young wandering sadhu noted for his exceptional intelligence. There he sat, cross-legged on a pile of straw, his only covering and incidentally his only possession being an ochre cloth draped over his shoulders. Truly a divine face smiled at us after we had crawled on all fours into the hut and pronamed at the feet of this enlightened soul, while the kerosene lantern at the entrance flickered weird, dancing shadows on the thatched walls. His face, especially his eyes and perfect teeth, beamed and glistened. Although I was puzzled by the Hindi, his expressions were very revealing. He was full of enthusiasm, love, spiritual glory. No one could be mistaken as to his greatness. Imagine the happy life of one unattached to the material world, free of the clothing problem, free of food craving, never begging, never touching cooked food except on alternate days, never carrying a begging bowl, free of all money entanglements, never handling money, never storing things away, always trusting in God, free of transportation worries, never riding in vehicles, but always walking on the banks of the sacred rivers, never remaining in one place longer than a week in order to avoid any growth of attachment. Such a modest soul. Unusually learned in the Vedas, and possessing an MA degree in the title of Shastri, Master of Scriptures, from Benares University. A sublime feeling pervaded me as I sat at his feet. It all seemed to be an answer to my desire to see the real, the ancient India, for he is a true representative of this land of spiritual giants. I questioned Karapatri about his wandering life. Don't you have any extra clothes for winter? No, this is enough. Do you carry any books? No, I teach from memory those people who wish to hear me. What else do you do? I roam by the Ganges. At these quiet words, I was overpowered by a yearning for the simplicity of his life. I remembered America, and all the responsibilities that lay on my shoulders. No, Yogananda, I thought, sadly for a moment, in this life roaming by the Ganges is not for you. After the sadhu had told me a few of his spiritual realizations, I shot an abrupt question. Are you giving these descriptions from scriptural lore, or from inward experience? Half from book learning, he answered with a straightforward smile, and half from experience. We sat happily a while in meditative silence. After we had left his sacred presence, I said to Mr. Wright, he is a king sitting on the throne of gold and straw. We had our dinner that night on the mellow grounds under the stars, eating from leaf plates pinned together with sticks. Dishwashings in India are reduced to a minimum. Two more days of the fascinating Kama, then northwest along the Jumna banks to Agra. Once again I gazed on the Taj Mahal, in memory Jitendra stood by my side, awed by the dream in marble. Then on to the Brindaban ashram of Swami Keshabananda. My object in seeking out Keshabananda was connected with this book. I had never forgotten Sri Yukteswar's request that I write the life of Lahiri Mahasaya. During my stay in India I was taking every opportunity of contacting direct disciples and relatives of the Yogavatar. Recording their conversations in voluminous notes, I verified facts and dates, and collected photographs, old letters, and documents. My Lahiri Mahasaya portfolio began to swell. I realized with dismay that ahead of me lay arduous labors in authorship. I prayed that I might be equal to my role as biographer of the colossal guru. Several of his disciples feared that in a written account their master might be belittled or misinterpreted. One can hardly do justice in cold words to the life of a divine incarnation, Panchanand Bhattacharya had once remarked to me. Other close disciples were similarly satisfied to keep the Yogavatar hidden in their hearts as the deathless preceptor. Nevertheless, mindful of Lahiri Mahasaya's prediction about his biography, I spared no effort to secure and substantiate the facts of his outward life. Swami Keshabananda greeted our party warmly at Brindaban in his Katayani Peeth Ashram, an imposing brick building with massive black pillars, set in a beautiful garden. He ushered us at once into a sitting room adorned with an enlargement of Lahiri Mahasaya's picture. The Swami was approaching the age of 90, but his muscular body radiated strength and health. With long hair and a snow-white beard, eyes twinkling with joy, he was a veritable patriarchal embodiment. I informed him that I wanted to mention his name in my book on India's masters. Please tell me about your early life. I smiled entreatingly. Great yogis are often uncommunicative. Keshabananda made a gesture of humility. There is little of external moment. Practically my whole life has been spent in the Himalayan solitudes, traveling on foot from one quiet cave to another. For a while I maintained a small ashram outside Hardwar, surrounded on all sides by a grove of tall trees. It was a peaceful spot little visited by travelers, owing to the ubiquitous presence of cobras. Keshabananda chuckled. Later a Ganges flood washed away the hermitage and cobras alike. My disciples then helped me to build this Brindaban ashram. One of our party asked the Swami how he had protected himself against the Himalayan tigers. Keshabananda shook his head. In those high spiritual altitudes, he said, wild beasts seldom molest the yogis. Once in the jungle I encountered a tiger face to face. At my sudden ejaculation, the animal was transfixed as though turned to stone. Again the Swami chuckled at his memories. Occasionally I left my seclusion to visit my guru in Benares. He used to joke with me over my ceaseless travels in the Himalayan wilderness. You have the mark of wanderlust on your foot, he told me once. I am glad that the sacred Himalayas are extensive enough to engross you. Many times, Keshabananda went on, both before and after his passing, Lahiri Mahasaya has appeared bodily before me. For him no Himalayan height is inaccessible. 2 hours later he led us to a dining patio. I sighed in silent dismay. Another 15-course meal. Less than a year of Indian hospitality, and I had gained 50 pounds.